Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
If you haven't noticed, David's not lecturing today. He was kind enough to give me the opportunity to speak to you guys about stuff related to holographic entanglement entropy and the real Takanagi formula and its extensions. So that's my job today. And let's see how this goes. So as I said, the topic today is real Takanagi and generalized versions of it. And the general idea of real Takanagi is a connection between entropies of subregions in the boundary theory and geometrical objects, so surfaces, that I'll define in a second, in the bulk. So this is one of the, some could argue, one of the most important entries to the ADICFT dictionary, because it's because of this that we can make a lot of advances in connecting information theoretic properties of the bulk with, well, of the boundary with gravitational aspects of the bulk, right? So just to review what you guys probably saw last week, or last lecture, the statement of real Takanagi is that if you have a boundary region B, let me draw this. So you start with a fixed time slice on the boundary, you fix some subregion B, there will be some reduced density matrix on B, which is just the trace over the complement of the full density matrix of the system at a given time slice. And the statement of real Takanagi is that the entropy of rho B, which is just the von Neumann entropy, trace of rho log rho, will be the minimum of this area function. So in particular, area of chi over 4g Newton, where chi is a surface that is anchored in the endpoint of this boundary region and extends throughout the bulk. So this will be chi. So what it's saying is that the way you compute boundary entropies is you look at all the surfaces at a given time slice that are anchored in the boundaries of this region B. You compute its area, you extremize the area, or you take the minimum of all the areas, and that is your von Neumann entropy. Right? This condition here, that chi is anchored in the boundary region B, is usually described as chi being homologous to B, which also means that there exists some bulk region B, small b, such that the boundary of this bulk region B is the surface union the boundary region you started with, right? So this boundary here is in the sense of the conformal compactification of ADS, right? Because you're including explicitly this conformal boundary B on the definition of the boundary of this subregion B. If you don't know what I'm talking about, forget it, but this is just for completeness. Now, after Ryo Takanagi, there came a series of later improvements which extends the range of applicability of real Takanagi to more general scenarios. So the first case, I guess we should say the second case because that was the first, is what we call HRT, or Houbini Rangamani Takanagi. So this R is not the same as that R, which is sometimes called also the covariant extremal surface. And this proposal generalizes Ryutakainagi to cases where the geometry may be time dependent. So you have no obvious choice of what this surface of constant time slice is, and you have no time-like symmetry. So there's no preferred slicing of the bulk geometry. And in order to define what this is, I'll have to draw a slightly different picture. So now you imagine this is a part of the ADS boundary. You remember the cylinder I'm drawing here. Imagine cutting the cylinder and opening it up, and I'm looking at it from the side. So the spatial directions go in and out of the board. And you define some boundary region B here. What the HRT formula says is that now the entropy of rho B will be computed by the formula, by the following formula. Where now extremal means that this area, the surface chi, is extremal. And it also satisfies the homology constraint. So in the picture here, the way you do it now is you fix the boundary region again. You consider all surfaces that are anchored in the boundary region and end in some at some finite distance from the boundary. You vary the area, or you vary the surface, let's say. And to first order in variations of that surface, the area is stationary. Right? So the reason why this is slightly different from that is because you're now just minimizing over a fixed time slice. In this case, I'm allowing for perturbations of the surface also in the time-like direction. And the constraint now is that chi is extremal. Right? And this, again, the reason why we call this covariant sometimes is because this makes no reference to some preferred time slice of the bulk geometry. This is really only only depends on the properties of this boundary region. And there are multiple Cauchy slices that contain this extremal surface. Any questions so far?
Yeah. Is the extremal surface in that case something that goes into the board? Like, if you were to draw the extremal surface, would it be perpendicular?
Yeah, so maybe there's a slightly better drawing that I could do. My artistic skills are very limited, so I apologize for that. Let's see if I can do it slightly better. Now, imagine if I open up the boundary like this, and I have some boundary region B here. So this is B, and this is the radial direction, let's say Z. That chi there will be something. You should imagine something that looks like this, right? So this is B, and this is chi. And there is some bulk region B here, again, that is bounded by chi in the boundary.
So I've got a question. So does it have to be a slice, or can it be like an extended object, like a three-dimensional object in it?
The boundary region B, you mean?
B could kind of extend as an area on the surface, right? And then you could have some volume in the bulk, or is that not covered by the HRT form?
Well, it is, but the idea is that, so states, right, in quantum mechanics are defined at fixed times, let's say. So it is full information defined at one constant time, let's say. In this case, so you could draw something like, I don't know if I should draw this here or not. Anyway, you could draw something like, you could imagine that this boundary region is actually some sort of causal diamond, let's say, of the boundary. And the entropy that you're computing is the same as the entropy contained in this causal boundary, right? Because the information in this region here, in this space-time region, can be fully traced back to this surface here, right? But the starting point should always be like, the first thing you should think about should always be that you're fixing some state at some time, whatever the time is. And that's what you're looking at. Now, the state here could also, like, it contains the same information as something defined on this surface, or any surface whose domain of dependence is the same as the original surface. But yeah, for simplicity, I will always be talking about some co-dimension one region of the boundary.
Okay,
so this is generalization of RT for time-dependent situations. Now there are two extensions again to include quantum contributions. And the first 2A, let's say, was due to Faulkner, Lukovitz, let me get this right, Malacena, which says that the entropy of the boundary subregion, rho b again, is now the same as HRT, minimum of the extremal of the area over 4 g Newton, plus now the entropy of any bulk fields that in the semi-classical picture live in this region B, that is bounded by chi in the boundary region big B, right? The reason why we call the, like, everything computed geometrically here is classical. The reason why we call this quantum is that now we're including the von Neumann entropy of the semi-classical bulk fields that live in the region bounded by the extremal surface. And finally, there's a last extension that I'll talk about, which is due to Engelhardt and Wall. And this is the fully quantum extremal surface.
Student. Okay, so he studied here 2011.
Who?
Ito Lefkovich.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's pretty cool. All right, and the final extension that I'll talk about is due to Engelhardt and Wall. And the formula is almost identical to Faulkner, Lukovitz, and Malacena, except that now the surface chi is determined by extremizing not just the area functional, but the sum of the area term plus the bulk entropy. And this you may recognize as the generalized entropy of chi. So the change from Faulkner, Lukovitz, Maldacena to Engelhardt and Wall is just that the surface chi is no longer just extremal in terms of the area functional, but is an extremal of the generalized entropy, which includes the contributions from the area and the bulk fields in the region bounded by chi and the boundary region you started with. Okay? Yeah?
When we say quantum correction, we mean the bulk theory, right?
Yes, yes. I mean that you're including non-trivial contributions from bulk quantum fields.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay. And that's what this bulk term means. It's just a semi-classical entropy of whatever bulk fields you have in the subregion B.
That's actually a question that I had is,
okay,
why does adding the bulk term mean we're considering quantum corrections?
Well, it's just what people mean when they say that they're including quantum corrections, right? You could interpret this as not, so this is quantum not because the geometry becomes quantum or you're considering quantum fluctuations or anything. This is still purely semi-classical on a fixed background. You call it quantum because the bulk entropy from the quantum fields is the von Neumann entropy of some semi-classical quantum field theory in a given curved spacetime. I guess it's a matter of terminology. If you consider this quantum enough to be called quantum, it's up to you. But
I guess the question is, we're always working in the coupling limits class for the bulk theory. We're always in the semi-classical region.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you have a question?
Oh yes. So how should we interpret the original board terms in the ACFT
context? Oh, everything here is equal to the same bulk entropy. Let's say the boundary entropy computed in the CFT. Now the difference is that different states in the CFT will have different semi-classical interpretations in the bulk, right? So imagining that you started with Ryu Takanagi, you're computing minimal surfaces on some empty ADS content, right? That would be something like vacuum in the CFT. Now if you start exciting the CFT, the entropies of subregions will change, and the semi-classical description of that will include something more non-trivial than just like empty ADS, and that's where these bulk contributions from matter fields could come in.
In the Engelhardt case, why do we need to map, like, extremize the surface for the one non-union entropy in the first? Because
in this case, why you mean why we would need to extremize the full generalized entropy?
Yeah. Well, why not just for the area? Because for the area we do that, but for like if you already have the entropy contribution from the bulk, why do we need to?
Well, because this surface B depends on chi, right? So it could be that the surface that is determined by extremizing just this part and then adding the bulk contribution between chi and that is not the same as the one that you obtain by extremizing both, right?
So it's just some definition.
Yeah, this is a definition, right? This is a definition of a quantum extremal surface. Again, it's not a quantum surface. It's still just some classical bulk surface. It is quantum because it is obtained by extremizing the generalized entropy, which includes quantum contributions. And the reason why this is possibly different from this is because B depends on chi. And sometimes, in some situations, which we may talk about today or maybe in the last lecture with David, this bulk term can compete with the area term, and you'll get some non-trivial quantum extremal surface that is different from anything that you would see classically. Classically in the sense of just anything up to Faulkner, Lukovitz, and Mathieson. All right, so the rest of the lecture will be essentially a sketch of a proof of everything I just wrote. I will write in some level of detail the arguments that would lead for sure to Ryu Takanagi, and if you're generous, to HRT. But I hope that once I have everything written down, it will be more or less clear how the things generalize also to get to full quantum extremal surfaces in the Engelhardt and Wolf formula. Okay? All right. So, proof, or I should say, sketch of HRT, right? Okay, so the first step is to prepare some state that you want to look at in the boundary theory. So start with some row of the boundary theory, row B, B bar. Where I selected some privileged split between some region B I'm interested in looking at and its complement. And once again, rho B is given by the trace over B bar of rho B B bar. And our goal is to compute the phenomenon entropy, right? But the phenomenon entropy is unwieldy beast because it requires taking the log of an operator that is infinite rank. We have no way of making sense of that in a way that is useful for us to compute anything. So we want to compute this, but instead, what we will do to compute it is something slightly more indirect, which is to compute the Rényi entropies, which are defined by this expression. Okay? And obtain the entropy of rho b. I should say rho b. And then obtain the Feynman entropy of rho b by taking a limit of n going to 1 of s n of rho b. Okay? Now, the reason why this makes our life easier is because actually what we're going to compute is not Sn for any n, because that would be just as hard, if not harder, than just computing the Feynman entropy directly. We're going to compute the Rényi entropies explicitly for integer n. Right? Then we hope to get some reasonable looking answer for this quantity in a way that doesn't obviously depend on n being an integer or not. We're going to close our eyes and just take the limit of that expression when n goes to 1 as if n was just a real variable to begin with. And we hope to get reasonable answers. Does everybody buy that? OK, I need you to buy that to proceed. So let's go. Now, the reason why this is easier to deal with is because Rényi entropies for integer n can be pictorially represented as Euclidean path integrals, right? And once you represent that as an Euclidean path integral, you can use the ADS-CFT dictionary to map that Euclidean path integral, which is some sort of generalized partition function, to partition functions evaluated with geometrical quantities in the bulk. And that's how we proceed. OK, so I wrote a few comments here on the sideboard, just because I was too lazy to write them down throughout the lecture. And there would be a bit of a detour to justify throughout the lecture, but I hope at least these two first facts you've seen at least once in your life, which are just a reminder of how we represent the states as Euclidean path integrals. So here I just represent, for example, the vacuum state. And the way you can represent the vacuum state in terms of a path integral is you fix some constant time slice, you fix some field configuration, you imagine some classical field configuration at that time slice. And the statement is that the vacuum wave functional in this case, so something like the overlap between the vacuum and this classical field configuration eigenstate, is obtained by a path integral over the lower half plane in Euclidean time of the Euclidean action, right? And here normalized by 1 over square root of z, where the z is the Euclidean path integral over the entire space. So it's the same thing as this, without this limit here, and going all the way with tau from minus infinity to infinity, right? So I mean, I'm going to imagine now that the state of the boundary theory that I'm looking at can be prepared also by an Euclidean path integral, right? Possibly with some sources turned on at some point and so on, so it doesn't have to be the vacuum. I'm just assuming that there is some representation of it as a Euclidean path integral. And a second thing that I'm going to use is the fact that when you compute traces over subregions with a path integral, the way it works is as is represented here, right? So imagine that you fix some region B with its complement B bar, right? You take the trace over B bar. Schematically, what you're going to do is you're going to, if you choose to do this trace in the basis of field eigenstates at constant time slice, you're going to sum over a bunch of field configurations this bra, or this object, which was the same that I just wrote before, and the conjugate of that, which is pictorially represented as just flipping it around in the time direction. And these two states are the same. In the path integral, it looks like matching the boundary conditions here and here. So it has the same effect as just performing an ordinary path integral now over this slightly different manifold, which contains this branch cut where the boundary region you're looking at is. OK?
I'm sorry. Could you explain to me the
question? So, does this picture make sense to you? So now, what this represents is, I should have written an integral here.
Dot dots are trying to say that I'm not looking at the region B.
The dot dots here are region B, right? Because these are the ones that in this picture I'm not projecting over any boundary state with fixed classical field configuration, right? So I'm matching this with this because this configuration is the same as this in the trace, right? So now I'm summing over all field configurations in this constant time slice and this and on these sides, right? But if I remember how the path integral works, this is the exact same effect as just computing a path integral over this entire thing, where now the only thing left is what came from the boundary region B that we were looking at.
Why are we ignoring the boundary region B? Like, shouldn't we include paths over the boundary as well? Or?
Well, so this is the representation of a state that is fully supported only on B, right? So pictorially, this is leaving now these entries where I could project some states purely on the boundary region B. Does that make sense? OK, what if I write this? Imagine, well, this is, I was hoping this would be more helpful. But imagine that instead of doing this, I did directly some phi b of x, rho b, phi prime b of x. Right? Imagine that I was computing this matrix element between two field configurations at region b. The way I would do it is I would define the path integral with boundary conditions being equal to phi b prime here and phi b here. And I'll proceed in exactly the same way. The result would be a path integral where now the boundary conditions on this region b would be in this lower cut, you'd be this. And in this upper cut, it would be that.
So we're thinking about B as a boundary condition. And because it's a boundary condition, it's something that we're given. So we don't want to sum over paths there. So
yes. Yeah, because we want to obtain any matrix element of rho B using this prescription. And that's how, yeah. OK. OK, if states, if the state rho can be represented like this, right, by exactly the same trick as I just did here, traces of rho b to the n will also be represented as pictures like this. So let's see, imagine that rho b can be represented as some path integral, right, which schematically, as I just saw, looks like this, right? Now, for example, if I want to compute rho b squared, right? So in any orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space where rho b lives, rho b squared has some matrix elements, let's say ij, right? Which are the sum over k of rho b ik, rho b kj, right? It's just matrix multiplication. Now imagine in your mind that you're choosing this basis to be made of field configurations at constant time slice. This trace is now going to become a sum over all of these field configurations. And when you contract two indices, you're matching the boundary conditions in the cuts corresponding to these matrix elements. OK? So the picture that it would draw now would be something like, I'm repeating what rho b is here, right? So this is rho b. This is rho b again. OK? And I'm matching the boundary conditions here. So this cut is connected to this cut. And these two things are matching, right? And then if I compute trace of this, this is the same as summing over j and making this equal to j. Right? Looking at this picture, what this does is it connects the boundary condition here with the initial boundary condition here. So this is mapped to this. Is everybody happy with this? I see confused looks all around, so I can try to explain this better.
The first confusion I have is why you draw the hole as a whole as opposed to say just a line.
If you're being rigorous, it is just a line, but it's hard to represent different boundary conditions in the lower side of the line and in the upper side.
Okay. I guess that's my question. Why do we have two different boundary conditions on the same line?
Because one corresponds to that bra here, and one corresponds to the sket. General matrix elements, like a general state row, will have non-zero matrix elements for different boundary configurations here. Now, in the path integral, those are represented by boundary conditions on either side of the cut, and that's why I need to allow for different boundary conditions if you're coming from this side or that side. And that's why also I fatten the line a little bit so it looks like a region, just because, well, this is already hard enough to make sense of by explicitly drawing these. If I just wrote a line, it would be hopelessly confusing.
I'm not sure I understand how this drawing over here with the loop corresponds to tracing over rho b squared.
Okay. Was it clear why, if I didn't take the trace of rho b squared, I would connect this line with that line?
Not quite.
Was it clear why, when I computed this trace here, I connected this line with that?
That's just maybe just the general path integral thing. When you have, is that just part of the same, x-axis? And so you're just...
Exactly. And the same thing is happening there.
And then it cancels out.
Yeah, it's not that it cancels out, it's just that the effect of doing that is the same as if you didn't know where this geometry came from and I just told you to compute the path integral here.
Oh, okay.
It's exactly what you would do. You would decompose onto some foliation, and in that foliation you'd be integrating over some field configuration. That's the same as taking the trace if you didn't have the cut.
But then why does one side...
So here, it's the exact same thing that is happening, right? Because now, before I took the trace of everybody, if I just computed the matrix product between these two matrices, what you would do is you would take two copies, right, of the matrix. You would match the columns of one of the matrix with the lines of the other, and you sum them up. So if these matrix elements are written in the basis of field eigenstates at some fixed time slice, you could represent that as a path integral. And you're summing over all possible field configurations at that time such that they match on either side of one of this rho b and the other of this rho b.
OK.
Right. So the reason why these two are connected is the exact same reason as why those two sides vanished when I moved from here to here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this matching of boundary condition. Can you also say that, like, how would you match the boundary condition for, like, rho b, rho b dagger instead of rho b, rho b?
Well, rho b is Hermitian, so it's the same, right?
That's true. I mean, like, okay.
What made you think of rho b, rho b dagger?
I wanted to see if you need to match one boundary to the other one of that,
If you want to represent the dagger of an operator, you would basically flip the path integral around.
So this is like.
So yeah.
Okay. I'm a little bit confused about what is ket zero here. I thought this is a vacuum state.
So that's. Yeah, so this representation of the path integral, if I don't specify anything here, it's just for the ground state.
But you also
But what I'm claiming is that the state I'm considering here, of course, it could be the ground state, in which case you could see everything that I'm about to do as a derivation of Ryo Takanagi for the ground state. But I could imagine that I'm also creating some excited state of the CFT by doing the exact same Euclidean path integral, adding some sources in some places. And I'm just omitting where those sources are.
But the path integral from the right-hand side is always for the ground state.
Unless I define some operator insertions here at some points, right? So that would not be the path integral for the vacuum state anymore. It would be some excited state that I could define. Or set it in the other way, you could imagine that you're defining what a new excited state is by the exact same path integral expression with additional sources inserted and operator insertion somewhere and so on. Yeah. So this derivation that I'm about to do works for states that can be represented as Euclidean path integrals, possibly with operator insertions at some points that I'm just omitting in the pictures because, well, the picture is just schematic anyway. So, All right, so this is the mechanics of how these things work for integer n. So in general, and here I forgot the 1 over z squared, right? Just because rho b came with this normalization factor of 1 over z squared. 1 over z, sorry. And so in general, of course, the mechanism by which this became this is exactly the same for any value of n. So the general result is that trace of rho b to the n. And again, once you connect this line with that line, and this final line with the initial one, you just have a path integral over some manifold that's just a number, right? And you could interpret that number as the partition function defined on this fancy geometry now, right? So the general statement is that trace of rho to the n is going to be some partition function that depends on n in the region B divided by z to the n. I'll emphasize that 1 to the n, where this z and b is the path integral, let's say, over this manifold mn of b, where mn contains say n copies of this of one single geometry connected cyclically like this. Okay? So I'm just defining a path integral over this whole object as a partition function on some geometry.
What is
Z1 is just, well, if I write Z1 here, does it make more sense? Z1 is just a path integral over an entire space in the original geometry started with. Okay, very good. Does anybody have any questions at this point? Okay. All that we have done so far was purely on the boundary side. So you could imagine that this subregion here was a subregion in the boundary. These geometries are geometries of the boundary manifold, and so on. So now, we're going to use the power of the ADS-CFT dictionary, right? What the ADS-CFT dictionary says is that this path integral on the boundary with some sort of fancy conformal boundary conditions is the same as a partition function on asymptotically area space, where this now is a gravity path integral with conformal boundary given by this replicated manifold Mn. Okay?
So the path integral over this n copies of the manifold, it will give us the vacuum, like the inner product between vacuum state and the field in this manifold. But in order to have rho b to the n, we need two copies of that, and then we, because.
Yeah, so this here was already. So to compute the product of rho with itself, you draw two copies. Right? You match the boundary conditions on the upper and lower cuts on one, on two other copies. And then you, when you take the trace, you connect the two endpoints.
But I don't see why this is the path integral in Z2, in M2.
Well, because if I just gave you this manifold, let's say, and I asked you to compute the path integral there, you would implicitly always impose the same boundary condition here as in here, and sum over all those. And the same with the boundary conditions here and here, and sum all of those as well. So the end results can be interpreted as exactly this trace of rho b squared. Right? Just imagine how would you compute the path integral, right? You would foliate in some way. You would put some sort of classical boundary condition there. You would sum over all of them. You would move to the next slice. And you do the same, and so on and so forth, right? Like, because this is connected to this, when you compute the path integral, the boundary conditions here are the classical field configuration at each element of the trace that you're computing are going to match by construction, because it's the same manifold. Like, it's the same points, it's the same set of points on a manifold, and the same for the upper and lower cuts. So that's why you could interpret that as a path integral over this n copies of the original manifold with this cut along the region B. Any more questions? Yeah.
Do we know what this manifold looks like?
Well,
just for the case of like one spatial dimension and one time.
Well, it looks like. Well, it looks like a Riemann surface in the complex plane. If you like that. I'm not that creative pictorially, so I don't know if I can say something more helpful.
Can you think of it as covering spaces because it like somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that help? Well.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Okay. So now we will do two assumptions, right? To solve this gravitational path integral. And this is what is gonna simplify our lives immensely. So this gravitational path integral, of course, is not solvable in general. It's just as hard to compute, if not harder, than the original one you started with. But so first, assumption, which is not really an assumption. It's more of a regime of applicability of the dictionary, will be the semi-classical limit which just means that this gravity path integral is approximated by a maximum of the exponential of the Euclidean action evaluated on some classical gravity background, where the background here is fixed by the requirement that the conformal boundary is the same as the replicated geometry that we're looking at, right? And the condition that of this being maximum just demands that this classical action is evaluated on a solution to the equations of motion of gravity, right? So this is the same thing that we've been using all over the course to compute stuff on the boundary in terms of geometrical quantities in the bulk. And the assumption two So I guess before moving on, I should say that this is the classical on-shell action on a given bulk geometry. And then the second assumption will be that the dominant solution of the bulk equations of motion to evaluate this classical action is also replica symmetric. So it satisfies the same cyclic symmetry as these geometries in the boundary. Bulk solution is also symmetric under cyclic permutation verb mutations. Okay. Now, this second assumption means that the bulk geometry that is dual to this conformal boundary with a bunch of replicated copies of the original states is fully determined by two quantities, right? Let's say bulk geometry determined by some metric, which I'm going to denote as G1 superindex n, just and by that I just mean that this is the metric on one single copy of this replicated manifold, which might depend on n because of the change in the conformal boundary that I'm looking at for each value of n. This is some bulk metric on one copy. And to define this bulk dual, I also need to define these surfaces, chi1 over n, which are the extension of the boundary of B into the bulk. So in this case, I will draw a very similar picture to the one I drew in the first board, or the second board, I think. Yeah. Which is that you're taking one single copy of the boundary with this cut along the region B. And you're saying that the bulk dual of this, with the boundary cuts here, will have these boundaries extended somehow in a connected way into the bulk. And that will define then some bulk region B in the interior, which, when you compute the gravity path integral, would be glued over on each of the copies as well. So you have the surface chi B with some region B in between. And that is the bulk codimension one region that is being glued over in the path integral when you compute that on the gravity side.
Sorry, you're saying that's codimension. Wait, is it supposed to be like a volume, or is it supposed to be flat?
Depends on what sense, like in what sense it is. So the region B in the boundary is codimension one with respect to the boundary spacetime.
Okay.
So the codimension, so the surface chi here is codimension two from the bulk perspective. And this boundary region is now codimension one from the bulk perspective. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, could you remind me again? Codimension 2, that means it's 2.
It's 2 dimensions less than the dimension of the manifold. But space-time here, in the bulk picture, has 1 extra dimension.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and we're saying, okay. And the bulk we're saying for now is just like 3 dimensions, so codimension 2 means it's 1. Wait. Wrong, confused.
So the boundary, let's say the boundary is 4 dimensional, so it's CFT 4.
Okay.
Well, in the easy case, let's say the boundary is 2 dimensional.
Okay.
Which is what I literally drew here.
Uh-huh.
So codimension 1 from the boundary means it's a line, right? But lines in the bulk, because the bulk is 3 dimensional, lines are codimension 2.
Okay.
Right? And a thing that is bounded by 2 lines is now some surface, which is codimension 1 from the boundary perspective. Mm-hmm. From the bulk perspective, sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So now we have set what the geometry is. It depends on the location of the surface chi, right? And on the boundary metric, on the bulk metric. The condition of extremality will be obtained by varying this boundary metric, varying this bulk metric and requiring that be a maximum. That would just impose the bulk equations of motion for the metric, right? And I also have to extremize under the location of the surface chi. But now, all we have to do is compute what is the gravitational action, and I think I have enough time to do that, in this replicated manifold with that given metric, right? So the idea is the following. Let's imagine that, so now compute gravity action on replicated bulk geometry. So this is a bit hard to draw, but what you should imagine here is now that you're taking this bulk geometry and you're doing the exact same thing that we did here, right? But now you're gluing together these two-dimensional surfaces from one copy to the other, right? If you look around points on the surface chi, what you're doing is let's say this is chi. And then you're moving around chi from one surface to the other, from one copy to the other, until you get back to the same manifold here. Okay? So this drawing is, if I were looking at the surface chi here, let's say, fix all of the other coordinates, just look at a coordinate that goes around chi from one surface to the other. Right? And this has periodicity 2n, or 2 pi, let's say. And you want to express this in terms of things that happen only in one copy. Right? So this is the n copies. Now I just express everything in terms of things that happen on one of the copies. Right? But by doing that, this single copy of this replicated geometry contains a conical singularity around chi. And the picture you should have in mind is something like what I drew here on the plane. Again, you should imagine that each tip of the cone here, like for each point along chi, I'm going to have something like the tip of this cone. And I'm identifying the two identifying points on the cone by this periodicity of 2 pi over n. And you could check that, as I wrote there, right? The idea is that when you have a conical singularity, it means that you have some curvature divergence at the tip of the cone. And the magnitude of that divergence is completely determined by the deficit in the periodicity relative to 2 pi. So here, the periodicity is 2 pi minus the conical deficit, let's say, which is 2 pi over n. So it means that that this conical deficit theta is 2 pi over n times n minus 1. And so the Ricci scalar has some divergence according to the reference that I just wrote on the other side of the board, which is just 4 pi over n times n minus 1 times a delta function evaluated on these coordinates on the plane around chi. Yeah?
Can you explain again why it becomes a singularity when we consider one of those like n copies of
things? Because you imagine that you're starting from this from this geometry, which contains copies that go around.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
This surface or this geometry is non-singular. Mm-hmm. So you can define an angle variable that goes around chi with periodicity 2 pi. Now you're defining another like single copy version of this manifold. So the periodicity now would connect this point to this point.
Okay.
But because this had periodicity 2 pi, this now has periodicity 2 pi over n. Mm-hmm. So it is as if I took that cone there, right? I took the plane, I cut a given angle, and I glued those two endpoints together. Now the periodicity is 2 pi over n.
So two halves are also like connected to each other when we consider one of them.
Yes, yes. So if I went around this point, mm-hmm. I'll go back to this point automatically by just walking by an angle of 2 pi over n. And now we're almost there. The only thing that we need now is to use the fact that the gravity action is in the Euclidean signature, right? It's minus 1 over 16 pi g integral of d dx square root of g r minus 2 lambda, right? So that means that if I evaluate this gravitational action now on a bulk geometry, which this conformal boundary and this bulk metric, right? Because the bulk geometry is just n copies of a given single copy, this will just be n times the gravitational action of a single copy, right? Except that the single copy geometry has a conical singularity, right? Because the Ricci scalar diverges around the surface chi. Okay? And so to compensate for that singularity, I need to add here. Let's do this in more detail. So I need to add here a term that goes like n times 1 over 16 pi g times the r on the singularity, which is 4 pi over n times n minus 1. The integral with the delta function just gives me the area of chi. I know this was a bit quick, but the idea was, when you compute this gravitational action, because it's proportional to r, any place where R diverges according to a conical singularity will come with a contribution that will be the delta function in the two-dimensional plane times some constants along the remaining directions. That will give the area of the cut, right, times the conical singularity or the angular deficit there. Okay? And all I'm doing here is I'm writing this as n times the gravitational action in one of the copies and canceling out the contribution from that part. Okay? All right. So this n cancels this. This 4 pi cancels this. This becomes just 4. And we have that this is equal to n times gravitational action in one copy plus n minus 1 times area of chi over 4 g newton. OK? And now we're pretty much done. Because when you plug this back there, you'll find that trace of rho b to the n will then be exponential of minus n times s. Just this contribution here. Times exponential of 1 minus n times area of chi over 4 g newton. Divided by z1 to the n. But z1 to the n is just going to be e to the minus s of g to the power of n. OK? This is the full dependence of trace of rho to the n on n. Now, this bulk geometry here could be different from this g for arbitrary values of n. But in the limit where n goes to 1, these two match. These two are the same, right? And this boundary surface chi, again, is determined by extremizing that action that I wrote upstairs. But because the contribution from chi just comes from the area, extremizing this just means that I'm extremizing the area function. So at the end, when you take s of rho b as the limit of n go to 1 of 1 over 1 minus n log of trace of rho b to the n, the result that I obtain is a minimum of the extremal of a over chi of 4 g newton, where this is over. And this is HRT. All right, I think I ran out of time, but this is the place that I wanted to get to the most. Does anybody have any questions?
Can you explain why it maximizes this procedure? Extremizes.
So the action, so the contributions to the partition function go with exponential of minus the Euclidean action, right? So maximizing the contribution to the partition function means minimizing the Euclidean action. The Euclidean action on that manifold comes with a positive contribution from the area. So extremizing the Euclidean action means once you, when you vary the location of the surface chi, means you're minimizing over the area. And that's how the two things connect. The requirement that this is an extremal of the area functional comes because the contribution of chi to the Euclidean action is proportional to the area with a positive coefficient, right, for positive n, n minus 1.
We are invoking WKB approximation.
Yes, yes. And yeah, that's it. That's how the proof of Brillouin-Takenaud goes. Now, you can imagine, now, if I had time, I would do something like ask you what changes if you consider matter contributions, and that will give you the quantum extremal surface formula. Can anybody see where that would change in the derivation? Almost. The gravitational action is the same as long as you assume it's Einstein gravity, right?
R
would change if you considered matter contributions, because the equation of motion would change for gravity, right? It wouldn't just be Einstein equations. It would be Einstein equations with the semi-classical energy momentum tensor of matter, right? But the key to the derivation is actually that equation that I wrote upstairs, the assumption one, right? If I included matter contributions, instead of writing Z ADS is the exponential of minus the gravitational action, I will write the exponential of minus the gravitational action times the partition function of the matter fields of that bulk manifold with the same replicated geometry and so on. So you just write that first assumption there as a maximum of e to the s times the partition function of the matter fields. And that partition function of the matter fields would be exactly the nth Rényi entropy of the matter fields. If you repeat the calculation from that board up to this point with the exact same reasoning, you would get exactly to a formula like this with the bulk contribution. And that would be quantum extremal.
I'm a bit confused about how we use the replica trick in general, but in particular, the replica trick, I guess in the beginning, it was very clear that it was on the boundary, and then at some point, you made this transition into the bulk,
yeah.
And I think I'm a bit confused about that transition, like where and how that's happened. So I guess like you used the ADS-CFT dictionary to write the partition function of like the boundary in terms of the bulk one.
Yeah.
I think I'm confused about how we like assumed or like used the replica trick in the bulk there. Like, can you explain that?
So we're using the replica trick for entropies of the boundary.
Yeah.
And we're indirectly also applying the replica trick for the bulk calculation when we assume that the bulk geometry that gives me the maximum contribution there is also replica symmetric,
so
right?
Maybe that's the assumption that I'm a bit confused about, assumption two.
Yes.
Why we can assume that, or like...
I mean, it's not obvious that you can assume that. And in fact, you are probably familiar with the fact that sometimes you cannot assume that. But this is just that. It's a step of the derivation that allows us to proceed, which may or may not be true depending on the boundary state that you're considering. So if you want, you could see this derivation as a derivation under the constraints that the boundary state that you're looking at is such that its bulk dual will end up being also symmetric under the same cyclic permutation. But it is an assumption. I didn't prove that. And in fact, that won't be true in general. It's an assumption. If that assumption holds, then the calculation proceeds in this way. And it becomes doesn't become very easy, but it becomes doable because it maps to an exactly analogous calculation in the bulk, which is why you have phenomenon entropies of bulk fields showing up if you included the matter contributions and so on. OK, I think I ran out of time, but I got to the place that I wanted to get to. So yeah, that's it.
Thank you.